Liz is an exceptionally experienced socialist who's been active in the socialist movement in Australia for a long time.
Well over 30 years.
She's also a prodigious author and has written a number of things, and in particular a book that I'm sure will be plugged later on, Revolution is for Us, which Phoebe here is selling, and you can purchase a copy. And, you know, she's got lots of experiences, particularly around the LGBT or gay liberation movement in Australia, and also in the trade union movement, which she's also published a book about the Builders Labourers Federation, which I'd encourage you to read as well. But I might... There's so many more things I could say about Liz. Including the fact that she keeps a clean car. Sorry, we won't talk about that. But we'll get straight into it. All right.
Nothing to do with my talk. Okay, thanks. Rights and revolutions are great for LGBTI rights. And this year we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the riot that sparked the beginning of the modern gay liberation movement. At New York's Stonewall Inn on June the 24th, 1969, when lesbians, trans, youth, gay men fought back against police harassment. In 1978, the ninth anniversary of Stonewall, when the right were mobilising and winning against LGBTI rights in the US, American activists called on gays internationally to march in solidarity. And the left here quickly organised. And organised a whole day of action in Sydney, a morning march, a forum, and then ending in Australia's first Mardi Gras, ending, as we all know, in a riot as the cops smashed their way through the parade. So I'll just see the first slide here. And Phoebe's going to hand round a booklet that's got pictures of the riot and some of the demonstrations that happened afterwards. So sort of avail yourself of that. But well before 1969... LGBTI rights were won in revolutions that swept nations, such as the French Revolution of 1791, resulting in the effective decriminalisation of homosexuality in countries which adopted the Napoleonic Code. And Engels commented at the time, and I'll quote, he said, "A phenomenon common to all times of great agitation is that the traditional bonds of sexual relations, like all fetters, are shaken off." The Russian Revolution of 1917 similarly brought sweeping reforms to all aspects of life, including removing homosexuality from the criminal code, giving gays the right to marry, and so on. So celebrating the 1917 Russian Revolution with his poem 150 Million, a tribute to all those involved, Vladimir Mayakovsky wrote, "We will smash the old world wildly. We will thunder a new myth over the world. We will trample the fence of time beneath our feet. We will make a musical scale of the rainbow." And Mayakovsky continues this rainbow image in the line, "A thousand rainbows will shake the sky." Now, he was writing about the whole revolution, but these are such wonderful images that I think we can appropriate them for the modern-day struggle for LGBTI rights. And I noticed there was a book about Mayakovsky in the bookshop, but also if you Google David Widgery, W-I-D-G-E-R-Y, you'll find his tribute to and sort of story about Mayakovsky. Very interesting person. But anyway, so back to the revolution. It was no wonder then that historian Gregory Carlton writes of this time, and I'll quote from Carlton, "People could not remain silent in the midst of a revolution that was the most audacious effort in history to give men and women freedom to live and love as they chose, to release them from the prejudices and restrictions of the past." And overwhelmingly, socialists have been at the forefront of the fight for liberation, not just in initiating many of the major actions, campaigns and organisations, but importantly in analysing why capitalist society has oppressed and repressed LGBTI people and how we can actually win liberation. A Marxist analysis that makes clear where oppression comes from and what are the forces that we have to fight. It follows from this what sorts of movements we have to build, what allies we seek, and ultimately how we can fundamentally change the world we live in. And just over 100 years ago, Lenin wrote that socialists and all those fighting on the same side for a better world need to react to every manifestation of tyranny and oppression, no matter where it appears, no matter what stratum or class of people it affects, and clarify for all and everyone the world historical significance of the struggle for the emancipation of the proletariat. If you want to sit on the sort of at the front here, you can. The German Social Democratic Party was the first to speak up in Parliament in favour of gay rights, against homophobic laws, and one of the few groups to publicly defend Oscar Wilde on the 13th of January in 1898. In 1906, the Australian Socialist Party, the Socialists, was speaking up for a cross-dressing person, Marion Edwards. How their article spoke more about the unfairness of employment for women, but they were in no way condemnatory of the woman who called herself Bill Edwards. So this is just a quote from what they said. Marion Edwards, who had been dressing in male attire for the last 7 years, says she first donned male clothes to enable her to get a living easier than she could as one of the gentler sex. And so they concluded, moral, equal pay for equal work and thorough training for both sexes with economic freedom for all. Now, Bill Edwards lived most of the time as a man and had relationships with women. A few people around that era did, some of them getting married as well. So across the decades, LGBTI activists have been in the forefront of other struggles too. So people such as Bayard Rustin, who was one of Martin Luther King's closest aides and an organiser of the 1963 March on Washington, where King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech. In Australia, I just found out about a week or two ago that a person called Charlie Reeve, who was in the International Workers of the World, or the Wobblies, he was a lead agitator, an organiser, and one of the Sydney 12 who were infamously jailed for a trumped-up charge of arson, was openly gay. So we've sort of found out from some of his letters that have been found. Also, in Australia, the first attempt to set up a homosexual law reform group in 1958 was Laurie Collinson, a Communist Party member. He was inspired by the attempts in Britain at the time to set up law reform. Unfortunately, Laurie didn't succeed. That's him there. He got people signed up, but none was prepared to have their names in public. He left Australia soon after, never to return, but he was active in sort of gay rights struggles in Britain. And then when Gay Liberation came out for the first time there, he was right behind it. So just go there. So that's sort of in the 50s more generally. So the 50s themselves, while they were repressive, they also had a certain freedom and a promise of something better. And far from being dull, as many describe or remember it, the 1950s proved to be a political and sexually challenging decade. There were clubs and hotel bars, frequented mostly by men because, generally they had greater freedom to walk into hotels and things. In the arts, some unionists in the railways and on the waterfront, Rod Anderson, who's in the Communist Party, were open about their sexuality. But, you know, it's true, many LGBTI people were closeted. And it wasn't just the usual fears of being outed, losing jobs, family and friends. Overlying all this was this sort of McCarthyite witch hunt atmosphere of the time, sort of the anti-communism as well. So for the first three decades, the Communist Party itself was in the firing line and fought years of censorship, ASIO surveillance, having the organisation banned, members' homes raided, some were jailed and others lost their jobs. And the party did succumb to the Stalinist influence. Writing about the Communist Party member Edna Ryan, Joy DeMussy describes how the party of the 1930s, where sexual freedom was practiced and a drag queen was welcome as a member, gave way to a more repressive party line. Nonetheless, among many of the young people attracted to the CPA were novelists such as Christina Stead and Jean Devaney, whose books included lesbian and gay male characters, sympathetically portrayed. And one writer about sort of gay history here in Australia, Gary Wotherspoon, comments, "The increased repression of the Cold War had exactly the opposite effect in the long run. As homosexuality was more talked about, even negatively, its heightened profile encouraged more questioning about social mores, more acknowledgement that homosexuality existed." And Marilyn Lake, historian here in Melbourne, sums up, "In contradistinction to the common view of the 1950s, and I'll quote, in attributing such uniformity and homogeneity to a decade, in accusing it of such self-satisfied complacency, the conventional view fails to acknowledge the social and political insurrections that provoked the very repressions that occurred. So sexuality's, you know, overall has never entirely gone off the agenda and now began to be really flamboyantly displayed in mainstream society as the era of rock and roll arrived. Rebellious young, mostly working class people, the so-called bodgies, boys, and widgies were the women, who embraced this culture, were backed by the Communist Party when they were censured by the press. And so Tribune, the Communist Party paper, wrote, and I'll quote, "Attempts at individual expression as a form of personal revolt against capitalism are not peculiar to this generation." And they go on, they contrasted the rebels of the 1950s to what were called the Lairs and Larrikins of the early 1900s, who came good in the fight against conscription in 1916 and 17, or the so-called jazz babies of the 1920s, who joined the later struggles in the Depression, and some of them becoming active socialists. So the paper argued that the rebellious behaviour of young people in the 1950s had a legitimate cause, particularly among the boys. So facing our bodgy boys right now is the threat of being conscripted for up to 5 years in Menzies' National Service Bill. So while the activism of the 1950s was critical in laying the basis for the later decades, the 1960s did change everything for the Australian left, as it did for the left worldwide. It broke the stranglehold of the Cold War. It drew in millions to the anti-Vietnam War movement, saw the rise of the new left, as well as the radical black women's and gay liberation movements. There was a crisis in the world in the communist parties, which led to numerous splits, and it saw a resurgence of the sort of splits in the Communist Party, leading to some of them breaking with Stalinism. Crucially, it saw a resurgence in working class combativeness that put the ruling class on the back foot for the first time in decades and made the talk of revolution credible again. And it was in all these areas that young lesbians and gay men, well, also older people actually, could be found. So they're marching on the streets for the Vietnamese, black and women's liberation movements, on the campuses, amongst the young militant workers, demanding fundamental change and asking themselves, why aren't we marching for our own liberation? Then they did. Earlier demos and riots in the US in the early 60s, good as they were, didn't build a movement, but the Stonewall riots did. Gay liberation was the outcome of the Stonewall riots. And so immediately after the riots, the left called the first meeting, proposing a follow-up rally, arguing that gays needed to get organised, to be out there in numbers, spread the word around the country, and announced a new movement, Gay Liberation Front, named as such, with the front, Gay Liberation Front rather than movement, as a signal to their support for the Vietnamese Liberation Front, National Liberation Front, and the Black Panthers. Similarly, in Australia, there was an early riot in Sydney in the 1940s after police tried to shut down one of the gay bars, and there was a person called Melba who was mid-performance when one of the cops came up and told her to get off the stage. And so Melba put a hand on her hip and said, "Just supposing you come up and get me, you young bull." Huh? So, well, all hell broke loose after that, and until Melba, with a triumphant cry, crowned the officer with a flower pot. But it didn't lead to a movement. It wasn't until the upheavals of the late 1960s and that the left was so closely involved with, and after 1969, that Gay Liberation was formed here. And shortly after forming, the first Gay Liberation banner appeared at the International Women's Day rally in March 1972. Not the banners that we have these days. But Gay Liberation was one of the last of the radical movements to appear on the Australian political scene. But it was very radical as of the time. So it said, "Gay Liberation has a perspective for revolution, based on the unity of all oppressed people. There can be no freedom for gays in a society that enslaves others through male supremacy, racism, and economic exploitation, that is capitalism. And it's no surprise then that the demands of gay liberation would be derived from, you know, those of the radical left. And in Lance Gowland's story, we see how some of this played out. Lance was based in New South Wales town of Goulburn and secretary of the Goulburn Trades and Labour Council. He'd been in the Communist Party's youth group and then joined the party. And by the late 60s, realisation that he was homosexual brought big changes in his own, you know, personal life, but he still remained completely committed to the party. He got a gay rights group going in Goulburn, but coming out was pretty hard in Goulburn in 1969. And so, not from the party, but as he says, the police were onto us and they were parked outside when we had our meetings and they were raiding our homes. And so he remembers that he and others were also against the American invasion of Vietnam. But now, as gays, they wanted to be part of what he called the great upwelling of the social movement struggle. So in 1970, he moved to Sydney, and I'll quote from him now. He says, because everything was happening there. I was very excited by it, and I wanted to come and join in and take part. He became one of the prime movers in the Communist Party's development of its gay liberation policy and strategy. Now, the Communist Party was the biggest left-wing group, and it was the first party to respond to gay liberation, even before a group had formed in Australia. Now, there were a couple of other sort of more reform-minded groups that had appeared at the end of 1969, 1970, but gay liberation came a little bit later. The Communist Party Youth Group had supported homosexual rights from 1971, while it took less than a year after gay liberation appeared for the party to change its public position and adopt pro-gay policies. And the next slide. And Tribune carried the first article in the Australian left press by a party member, Dennis Freeney, on the 26th of May 1971. Sorry for the quality, but that came off a film thing, so it's not very good. But as Dennis noted in his autobiography, he'd been reading reports of the new movement in the Trotskyist papers from America and had found the militancy and leftism of gay liberation in the USA much more to his liking than the reform groups here. And Freeney reminded his readers of the Russian Revolution's gains in decriminalising homosexuality, the links between the gay liberation front and women's and black movements and the anti-Vietnam War struggle, and how the demands for liberation were part of the socialist agenda. He spoke later about the left strategy of organising an activist minority that could bring people in around more left-wing demands and build a stronger fighting movement. The main job then was to go out and confront oppressive institutions involving mass work such as demonstrations. And Freeney concluded, we've got to find those demands which are really challenging, not the lowest common denominator. We've got to start from real felt oppression and at the same time link it to the real causes. For him, it was socialism and the role of the working class that was the key, while the causes came from the operation of the capitalist system. So Phoebe will now just hand round some leaflet things. There's about nine of them altogether, but they give you a bit of a feel for some of the things that were going on during the period, the 1970s, that I'm talking about. So the 1970s saw two new left-wing Trotskyist groups form. The Socialist Workers' Party, which is now the Socialist Alliance and no longer a Trotskyist group, and the International Socialists, and Socialist Alternative is a descendant of that group. And together with the Communist Party, they pushed for mass actions, a public activist stance, and also, importantly, union involvement, organising within the unions, changing attitudes, getting workplace-based anti-discrimination laws in place, and action to back them up. So gay contingents also marched on May Day in... So the first one was May Day in Melbourne, and if you've seen the earlier print run of my book, that was the cover that we had on that one. The next one is Sydney 1981, where the left was marching in May Day. And then the last one is for this bit is a group called Enola Gay, a group of gays who marched in the anti-nuclear demonstrations, and they took their name from the plane that dropped the bombs on Japan. So two unions in particular, both in New South Wales and or both of them in New South Wales, stand out in their support of LGBTI rights in the 1970s. the Teachers Federation, which is now the Australian Education Union, and the Builders Labourers Federation, which is now in the Construction Union, the CFMEU. Now, they were the first unions and amongst the first organisations to take a stand for gays. The plumbers were another. Over 1973 and 1974, the BLF threatened to ban construction at Macquarie Uni to support students Jeremy Fisher and Penny Short when they were discriminated against. The teachers' union supported Penny when she was stripped of her teacher's scholarship on the grounds of not being a fit and proper person because she wrote an explicitly lesbian-themed poem for the student paper. And this is the next one is that's the Socialist Youth Alliance marching down the streets sort of to support Penny in a big demonstration they had outside the education offices. When Jeremy Fisher went to the student union with his case, CPA members in the student union at Macquarie knew who to call. In both cases, the unions, both the teachers and the BLF, were headed by members of the CPA, and it was the adoption by the party of policy supporting liberation that gave these unions the political arguments to raise the issues and win support in the workplace. Now, the next slide is about a group called the ACSPAR, which I won't go into, but it's it was a white-collar umbrella organisation similar to the ACTU. Now, they merged a couple of years later, but in 1979, they had a conference that brought in a whole lot of unions from a whole range of unions, you know, some people from the Vehicle Builders Union, things like that, to a conference to talk about homosexual rights in the workplace. And in fact, the strongest social movements have always had links between trade unions, the left groups, and their particular causes. Now, Ken Davis tells how he joined the Socialist Youth Alliance, as well as the local ALP branch, in 1972 while he was still at school, and a year before he actually came out. And so despite the SWP-SYA support for gay liberation, Ken initially questioned why sexuality would be of interest to the working class or, you know, gay groups. And he said it was Marxism that taught me that our sexual lives were socially constructed and it was not a question of sort of personal blame or personal sort of attribution. The BLF support for Jeremy Fisher and Penny Short was also important in sort of more generally developing Ken's views. And he came out the day that the left had organised a rally in support of the Allende government in Chile, and it was also Sydney's first gay pride demonstration. And he went to both, commenting there was a tremendous intersection between a whole lot of issues, whether we liked it or not. Now, this first sort of activist period ended in 1973, sort of into 74. Activism didn't stop, but there was a change in the politics and a fragmentation of the movement. The radicalisation was ebbing worldwide as the bosses went on the offensive, and the working class started to retreat. There was an adoption of radical feminist, separatist identity politics, pushing socialist politics of working class alliance and mass struggles somewhat to the sidelines. So, you know, while I've been sort of emphasising the role of the left parties, we have to understand the radical left organisations had an impact out of proportion to their numbers, particularly the two new Trotskyist groups. Their small size put real limits on their ability to argue for and win the alternative case for socialist politics as the situation changed. However, 1975, which is a period of huge, you know, political upheaval with the Kerr coup and the overthrow of the Whitlam government, started to see a change. So on the campuses, it was sparked by a newly formed homosexual caucus in the national student body, which was Australian Union of Students. It's now NUS. The caucus was, according to one member, a coalescence of talent and experience in one critical mass, and included a new layer of activists from the CPA, SWP and IS. The caucus won AUS conference adoption of pro-homosexual motions and, crucially, a campaign to take these to every campus across the country for student endorsement. This was the left strategy to build wider support for gay rights, and they won. The motions were passed on a majority of campuses and there were, you know, amidst some keen campaigning. And at the same time, a motion to support the Palestinian struggle, which also included taking it to the campuses, failed. So, you know, it was important that they actually won this time. There was also the AUS conferences where the left could go in and could really be part of, you know, bringing up the issues of class struggle, bringing up the Marxist analysis of oppression and so on. So that went on through 75, 79. You got Mardi Gras, and all the events that happened after that. In Melbourne there was March a couple of days after Mardi Gras. 15th of July was the biggest rally, 1,500. Nobody had ever seen that number of gays on the street, joined by a whole range of people because everybody understood that these attacks were on everybody's rights because it was having to have a permit to go on a march, all of that sort of thing. And then there was a third march, which the next photo just shows you, down from the 4th National Homosexual... No, oh, wait, it's gone. Don't worry about it. Lost. So anyway, the Mardi Gras, you know, the drop the charges campaign won, both the right to demonstrate without police permission and also all the charges. There were hundreds of people who were charged and the police said they lost the paperwork. I don't think so. Anyway, there were a whole range of things happening during 1978, including the next one here, which is A Young Gay and Proud, which was a booklet put out by a group of gay teachers and for kids talking about issues of sexuality, coming out, support groups, all of that sort of thing. In England, we had a morals campaigner called Mary Whitehouse, who had the gay publication Gay News convicted of blasphemy. And she was headed out here, backed by Fred Nile, who people in New South Wales will know very well, and the so-called Festival of Light. There's in one of the things going around, there's a thing that the Festival of Light put out with Mary Whitehouse. Mary Whitehouse came out to Australia... She had the rallies, but we also counter-demonstrated. And, in fact, the Festival of Light lost a whole lot of money from the thing because one of our members got on the mailing list for the Festival of Light and found out from their reports that they lost all this money with the tour. So the next thing is from the front cover of the Battler, which was the IS paper. I shouldn't be that. The early gay liberation movement had promised revolution, and along the way we had our riot. But 1978 was, in effect, GLM, the gay liberation movement's swan song, and by the end of the 1970s, gay liberation was no longer. Craig Johnson, a leading activist and Communist Party member, summarised the process as changing the political framework from, in his words, oppression to discrimination, from liberation to rights, and from movement to community. It was led by the CPA, in fact, and was part of their retreat from class politics. While it didn't mean the end of gay activism, revolution was also no longer in the air more generally, and the focus was on reform. More broadly, the bosses were on the attack, and there was a worldwide downturn in political and industrial activity. The revolution had been postponed. Now, none of this can take away from the real gains of gay liberation and the role of the left in founding and building such a liberation movement. Stonewall was not the first LGBTI riot in the US, but it was the first to turn into a liberation movement because this time the left organised a march soon after to celebrate and protest and turn a riot into an ongoing fight for liberation. Gay liberation was transformational. It changed lives, millions of people's lives worldwide, with its defiance and pride. In Australia, as elsewhere, the movement and the activists who built it made possible for people to live, work and love more freely. Discrimination and oppression still existed, but gay liberation gave LGBTI people more strength to continue the fight about discrimination and laid the basis for the campaigns to come. So with AIDS, you got ACT UP, with the attacks from John Howard on marriage, we've got the Equal Love, Equal Marriage campaign, and now we've got Safe Schools and the fight against transphobia and for trans rights, all of which have been led by left-wing activists, many from Socialist Alternative. From the first, we needed to take the struggle onto the streets with challenging demands and to look to the union movement for active support, as did happen. And I can't make this point too often. Never forget, it was the left who pushed for that from the beginning and is still arguing this in the face of attempts to focus campaigns on lobbying, either Labor or the Coalition, voting for sympathetic Liberals or independent, so-called independents like Karen Phelps, or other sort of dead-end strategies. And I'll just conclude here. Overall, it was Marxism and the left political organisations which brought all those issues into a coherent worldview and outlined a comprehensive and achievable strategy for change that linked the fight of all the oppressed with class struggle against the system of capitalism and the need to build a revolutionary party out of the struggles of the day. And the strength of the communist position, says Phil Carswell, was that it drew, and I'll end with a quote from him, this absolute connection between homosexuality and feminism and the fight for gay rights and the fight against capitalism, that they were inextricably linked. It gave people a chance to have a worldview and an organised political response. Thank you.